Lux Occult is a part of the Green Mushroom Podcast Network.
As freedom is a breakfast food, or truth can live with right and wrong, or molehills are from mountains made, long enough and just so long, will being pay the rent of seam, and genius please the talent gain, and water most encourage flame. As hat racks into peach trees grow, or hope stands best on bald men's hair, and every finger is a toe, and every courage is a fear, long enough and just so long, will the impure think all things pure, and hornets wail by children stung. Or as the seeing are the blind, and robins never welcome spring, nor flat folk prove their world is round, nor dingsters die at break of dawn, and commons rare and millstones float, long enough and just so long, tomorrow will not be too late. Worms are words, but joy is the voice. Down shall go which, and up come who. Breasts will be breasts, thighs will be thighs. Deeds cannot dream what dreams can do. Time is a tree, this life one leaf. But love is the sky, and I am for you. Just so long, and long enough. That is E.E. Cummings. Hello and welcome to Lux Occult. This is the podcast where we gleefully taunt the mundane, butcher the Latin, and most other languages, and we also discuss a variety of occult topics. Exploring the intersections of magic, art, science, philosophy, technology, and so much more. Occultism for everyone. I'm your host, Lux Estrada, and if you're hearing the sound of my voice, that means that this show, and magic for that matter, are for you if you want them. There are a lot of different ways to be more free, and using magic or making space for a spiritual practice in your life can be one of them. As always, I don't speak for anybody but myself. Others can, will, and should disagree with me sometimes. After all, how would we ever learn anything if we all agreed all the time? And like those who attempt to be reasonable should be willing to do, I am always willing to revise my opinions based on new evidence. All right, so I'm very excited to share this episode with you today. I spoke with author Ramon Castellanos about the concept of wildness and his new book, In Praise of the Wild Spirit, which he is busy working on now. Ramon shares some fascinating perspectives about how we, as modern humans, interact with what he calls the current of domestication, and what this force looks like in our lives. He also shares about some lessons he's learned from working with wolves, and how wildness is an intrinsic quality that captivity does not erase. How does wildness look on an archetypal level? What might it offer us? And how might we have more of it in our lives? Ramon has some great pointers on ways that we can rewild, and spoiler alert here, magic is one of them. I also spoke with Flood, host of the XV Planets podcast, another fine show here on the Green Mushroom Podcast Network, about what he's getting up to this summer. So him and the rest of the XV Planets paranormal investigation team have some wild plans involving a god helmet and an area in the Uinta Basin near Skinwalker Ranch. And they're planning to conduct some paranormal experiments there. Flood also lets me know about a new spin-off project he's going to be starting soon that I'm really excited to be getting involved in. And you can too. More on that to come. I'll also talk a bit about my experiences at VR. There's still a lot to process, but it was an amazing time. Thanks so much to Lorelei Black and Yara and all of the amazing organizers and other folks who made it a very fun and memorable time. We'll do some updates about the Green Mushroom Project. And there's also some Jack Parsons writing that I would like to share as well. It's going to be a wild time. But before we get any further, I'd be remiss not to say thank you so much for listening. I really do appreciate you taking the time to hang out with me and my awesome guests here on this show. I'm beyond lucky to have such amazing listeners, collaborators, cohorts, co-conspirators, what have you. Truly, the audience of this show is some of the coolest, smartest, probably sexiest, and most interesting people I've had the pleasure of interacting with, and now sometimes meeting in person, which has also been cool. I might be biased, but it seems accurate to say this. You are all the bee's fucking knees. As always, I welcome people's thoughts, questions, comments, suggestions, arcane revelations. You can reach me at luxoccultpod@gmail.com, or you can hit me up on Instagram at luxoccultpod. And if you like the show and the other stuff that I've been getting into, you can support it on Patreon. And if you do so, you can take a bibliomancy break with me. There are no tiers or levels or whatever, so give as you will. Buy Me a Coffee is another option for those who wish to share their support with a one-time donation and don't feel like going through the whole Patreon rigmarole or whatever. So thank you so much to everybody who is already, you know, supporting the show with money and with, you know, telling their friends about it and spreading the word. Support makes it possible to do this, and I really do appreciate it. So thank you so much. All right, so I will be back later on to do shoutouts and introduce the episode within the episode. But now, think about this. What is wildness, and how does it look on an archetypal level? What might it offer us, and how might we cultivate more of it? If that's correct phrasing, can wildness be cultivated? Or is that the process of cultivation anathema to the concept of wildness? Not sure. Write to me at luxoccultpod@gmail.com and let me know what you think about that. Okay, so Ramon Castellanos grew up in a household devoted to shamanistic traditions connected to the African diaspora, where he was initiated and taught how to work with magic from a very young age. As a teenager, he underwent several spiritual crises, spontaneous kundalini awakenings, and later multiple physical illnesses. He spent 10 years living and working at a wolf sanctuary in the Zunai Mountains of New Mexico, where his experience of the wildness and wild animals helped shape his view on the human condition. His own healing led him to work closely with multiple spiritual teachers, and he now holds instructorship capacities in a variety of systems of internal alchemy. He is the author of the book The Ancestral Now, as well as a teacher and facilitator of healthcraft, healing alchemy, and ancestral reconnection. So you can also hear another conversation that Ramon and I had in episode 57. He joined me for the episode within the episode on this one. This one's called Love and Other Dangerous Magics with Mademoiselle Vendrati and The Ancestral Now with Ramon Castellanos. So check that out. It's a good one. All right. Well, without further ado, let's get wild here and talk about wildness with Ramon Castellanos. Cheers. All right. Well, my guest today is Ramon Castellanos. Ramon, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Lux. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for returning. I'm so excited to hear about wildness, your new book, and all of the rest.
Cool. Yeah, I'm excited to talk about it.
So where did you kind of start with working on this project?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting question. In some ways, it started at the Wolf Sanctuary. You know, for the people who are not really familiar with my work, I spent a decade living and working in the wilderness at a wolf sanctuary in the mountains of New Mexico. And, you know, this was straight wilderness, 2.5 hours away from any major city. We were living in log cabins, traditional log cabins called hogans, which is really just six walls of logs slapped together, often on a dirt or concrete floor without any amenities, any modern amenities by any means. And, you know, living around wild animals of all types, including very especially so wolves. And I started thinking about wildness a lot at that point in time. Even though, I can talk a little bit more about this. It seems as if wildness was kind of a key feature of my life in other ways, in terms of my initiation into the Ifa and Orisha tradition. I can talk a little bit more about that later, but just to keep on track, I started thinking a lot about wildness at that point, and it's been on my mind continuously, and also something that I've attempted to bring into my lived experience and to understand on a more gut and bone level what that means for us as human beings today for at least over a decade, right? So the book itself has started to crystallize into something tangible over the last about 6 months or so. And the project, you know, the name of the book is called In Praise of the Wild Spirit, which is a nod to multiple things, including the fact that the wolf sanctuary that I worked at was called Wild Spirit Wolf Sanctuary.
Okay, very cool. I love that. I've actually spent some time in the mountains of New Mexico myself, and it's definitely a really magical kind of space, at least in my experience. So that sounds really amazing.
Yeah. It was definitely an interesting experience. Beautiful, raw, challenging, rewarding. Many different things occurred for me there. So yeah, the book itself is a look at what wildness is on a broad archetypal level, and then also what wildness means for human beings living in the modern world and how we can align with that. It also looks at a contrasted view of wildness in some senses, that is domestication. So I think when we're talking about wildness, often we do so because we have to contend with the forces of domestication. Because if we didn't have to, I think it would be a less relevant conversation, right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that's the overall theme of the book that I'm writing. Yeah, so it did start in the wilderness of New Mexico, and a big reason of why I want to call it In Praise of the Wild Spirit, and I mentioned the Wolf Sanctuary, is because I want to actually draw in stories from my connection to the wolves, things that actually happened to me in that time that they transmitted to me directly through the medium of story is what I want. It's how I want to share it in the book. So that's going to be an aspect of what I'm doing, and I think it's important because a big part of what I've come to understand about wildness has come of the result of spending time directly with the wolves and the wild animals there.
Fuck yeah. So some of what is going to be in this book is taught to you by these wolves. I fucking love that. Very cool.
Yeah. in fact, the book starts off with a story about a wolf and an interaction that we had, which kind of shook me to my core. So I can share that if you want, or we can kind of move in a different direction and talk about the broader...
I mean, I think the listeners would be mad at me if they don't let me tell the story. I'd love to hear it.
Sure. Well, so okay, a little bit of background. The director of the sanctuary at the time, he was really, really interested in expanding our reach in order to get a bigger donor base, which, I mean, I understood why, because we were completely donation based as a sanctuary. So if we didn't have money coming in from private donors, nothing would happen. And we were not a very wealthy sanctuary by any means, even though we were at the time one of the best sanctuaries in the country for what we were doing. So because of that, he decided that he wanted to take everybody to the state fair at the time in Albuquerque. And so again, this was 2.5 hours away. And it was a very stressful time for all of us because we were literally leaving the sanctuary at 4:30 in the morning to get back the next day at 12:30 at night. And we were taking wolves with us every day to do this. So everybody was underslept, everybody was stressed out, and so were the wolves for that matter. And, you know, after a couple of years of doing this, we said we weren't going to do it anymore because it was just too stressful for everybody. But that gives context. And we were setting up an enclosure, a large 20 by 20 chain link enclosure inside of a building that we had wolves inside of, and we were inside the enclosures with them. So as people passed by, they could see the wolves and we could talk about them and educate people. Well, one of the wolves that was there on this specific day, his name was Flurry, and he was an Arctic wolf. And I mean, a beautiful, white, full-grown Arctic wolf, very amenable wolf to being in the public, which is rare. And he was stressed out because he had barely slept. We had woken him up at 4:30 in the morning to have him travel 2.5 hours inside of a van to set up inside of this enclosure. And just before we had gotten into this enclosure, he was being really lovey with me. He wanted me to comfort him. So in the back of the van that we traveled in, I was able to pet him and he was kissing me and I was rubbing his belly. To be clear, that is very rare for a wolf to allow anyone to do. But because he was stressed out, he was like, please comfort me. So I was like, okay, he's being cool. Well, I saw that he was in a bad mood. He was pacing around the enclosure. He was just upset that he was in these circumstances, right? And I reached out to comfort him. And little did I know at the time that I wasn't picking up on his signals. What he was really asking for was for my wife to go in and comfort him because she was the resident wolf whisperer, so to speak, at the sanctuary. She just has a gift with animals. And I reached out and I pet him and he turns around and literally gets an inch from my face and growls in my face and bares his teeth. So I'm sitting down and I have a full grown Arctic wolf literally baring its teeth an inch from my face and growling and communicating to me, telling me to get the fuck out of his face that he does not want me to be there. So I put my hands up, I stand up and I walk backwards out of the enclosure. And at the time I'm pretty upset about this. Emotionally, I was kind of bent about it, even though he probably got over it like literally seconds after it happened. But that interaction of having this Arctic wolf growling in my face transmitted something to me about wildness. Some of that is hard to define. Some of it I can share. But there was this clear transmission of communication that awoke something deep inside of me that told me something about wild animals, basically. It communicated an aspect of their nature. And it didn't matter that just an hour before I was petting his belly and he was comfortable with me doing so. In that moment, he was a sovereign being who simply didn't want what I had to offer and made it very clear. He also showed me a range of emotional intelligence that you do not see in their domesticated counterparts, which are dogs. Because by the time that a dog is ready to get an inch from your face and growl and snap and tell you to fuck off, that's when you're about to get bit, right? He understood that he didn't need to bite me. He understood that he could literally communicate to me and that I would understand it. And he also, he treated me in some ways kind of like an equal. It's interesting, you know, because if it were another wolf, the situation might have been different. He understood that if he had bitten me, because he might have bitten another wolf in the same circumstances, and because wolves have very thick layers of fur, he probably would not have injured the wolf, but he knew he would injure me. So it was just this level of sovereignty, of ownership of his own circumstances, and of knowing where things stood for him on multiple levels, and then being able to transmit that in a very clear and concise way through his language that he understood to be within the range of acceptable for the assault, so to speak, that I had on him, right? He did not move straight to bite me, which he could have. So yeah, that right there just shook something inside of me. And also, I think there's something very primal about having an Arctic wolf growling in your face. And that really showed me that wildness was, or at least that was a big trigger, a catalyst. It showed me that wildness was a state. Wildness was a state of being. It was, at least in biological creatures, and we can talk more about what I mean by that. It's a state of being that is not dependent on having been raised in a particular set of circumstances, if that makes sense. Because these animals were still wild animals, despite having been born in captivity and raised by humans. They still had that inside of them, in the way they orientated, in the way that they understood their place in the world, in their boundaries. And that's when things started really to click for me, because I had, of course, been interested in ancestry and tribal cultures and understanding, you know, how those themes have moved into the modern world, right? What we have inherited from a deep time perspective. But the wildness piece became more tangible at around that time for me.
Okay, very cool. Fuck yeah. So you mentioned the idea of sovereignty in regard to wildness, and I was hoping you could sort of like go into what you discovered about this archetype through doing this work.
Yeah, well, so I think that it's one of those things of going around the world to get to the next block. So let me kind of back up a little bit to talk a little bit in broader terms.
Sure.
So wildness, as I have come to understand it, and I think I mentioned this in our last podcast together, is obviously, it's apparent, it's the baseline state of the universe as far as we can tell, right? So we often think about wildness in biological terms, right? But wildness is the sun, is a wild force, right? No one has domesticated the sun. you know, supernovas are wild forces. If there's alien creatures on other planets that have yet to get to the point of being domesticated, they're wild creatures. So wildness is really at some level a baseline of how the universe seems to work as far as we can tell, right? This is from the human reference point on this planet. So when we're thinking about wildness, we're thinking often, most people, we're thinking about it in our own terms as individual people, right? And to do that, we really have to think about why we're even having that conversation. And that's because of domestication. And domestication, as far as I can tell, is simply a type of technology. And I'm not even saying that domestication is antithema to nature, right? I think that domestication happens as a part of nature. We're all a part of the natural world. So you can't really say that it's not a natural thing. But it's a very constricted and narrow application of a set of constraints and parameters onto something in order to use it as a resource, basically. So when we look at domestication, we're looking at the control and constriction of a particular species and or other, right? Some other living animate force in nature in order to generationally shift it and modify it so that it serves our purposes more, or the purposes of whatever institution is domesticating it, right? So
yeah, that seems like a good definition. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, that doesn't happen readily in most of the natural world, as far as we can tell. It happens in some instances, right? We see it sometimes in ants. I think ants have been known to farm other creatures, right? There might be other examples of that type of behavior. Human beings have gotten pretty good at it, and we've been doing it, as far as we can tell, for, you know, 5,000 years, maybe something like that at the most. There's maybe some give and take around that. But we've been using that technology, basically, to achieve a certain type of outcome, which in this case would be more stability and more predictability. Because when we have a predictable food supply, then we can set up shop and remain more stable and be less nomadic. And then we can also grow as a civilization, et cetera, et cetera. It's been used for a purpose. And now, at this point, it's in full swing and being applied to culture, to civilization, to individuals at large. And at this point, most people don't even recognize the domesticative current, right? It's not even something that most people can palpably point out and say, well, this is where it's at in my life. So when we're looking at it that way, as an outside force imposing upon you over generations specific constraints in order to change you so that you better serve as a resource, as a commodity, then we understand that in some senses what they're doing is robbing us of sovereignty in order to suit their agenda, whoever they are, and that what we have to do if we want to move in a different direction is to regain our sovereignty, which in this case simply means to be self-directed, self-possessed, and self-owned, then that's what I mean by sovereignty in this case. And there are multiple layers to that because the domesticative current takes over your whole life, really. That's its intentionality, really. And so, yeah, does that answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. I really like this idea of the domesticative current. And I'm thinking about this and the idea of a current of energy. Like, I often think about it in terms of circuits, right? About things flowing both ways. Mm-hmm. And I wonder to what extent this domesticative current, you know, it offers us safety and security. So it's sort of like we're getting something, but it's also taking something from us too. And we might not realize that. Sort of just kind of to touch on the idea of, like, you know, selective breeding and stuff, that, you know, this idea of domestication through processes like selective breeding is something that we've been doing forever as a species. Basically, it's like one of our deals. But it's interesting, like, somebody, a lot of people have kind of looked at these interactions. A kind of pop culture version of this is Michael Pollan's Botany of Desire, where he talks about, like, you know, who's kind of in control in this kind of situation. Is it us, you know, doing things so that the plants will do stuff for us? Or is it the plants offering us things that we like so that we'll plant them everywhere and be their servants or whatever? So that's, like, this really kind of interesting way of looking at that. But this is still under this idea of this force of domestication, I would say. And yeah, fascinating stuff. Okay, so where do you think we would look in our lives? Like, could you give me an example of where you see this force that might surprise people or might be hard to recognize?
Yeah, sure. Well, so I can talk about it still in a little bit broader of a way, and then we can narrow down from there. So when it comes to it showing up in your daily life, well, so in a lot of ways, it's kind of like the water in which we swim. And that's the hard part for people to recognize. So if you are a member of civilization in the modern world, and unless you have done a lot of introspection and a lot of sovereignty work, it's likely that you have value structures that are not really yours, that are not truly chosen by you. And by value structures, I mean the things that you think are important and worth acting upon. And the things that people value in this way are really the things that direct someone's life. People can often say that they value something, but their life itself usually actually shows you what they truly value, right? The outcomes in their life really tell you what's
important. Yes, actions speak louder than words. Indeed.
Correct. Yes. And so a lot of people are living lives that they did not really choose. They're lives that are chosen by them by usually it's like the big three or four, one might say, government policies or politics in this case, religion and or the institutions built around religion, and in some senses, ancestral structures that we have inherited. And these forces are all in some ways, especially the modern, or let me say, modern is the wrong word, the relatively newish ancestral structures is what I'm referring to, not the ancient ones of deep time. All of these are domesticative currents, right? Because government is a regulating force that's trying to direct the flow of the world as we have it now and control it so that it can fit their perceived agenda. Religion does the same thing. Religion is very invested in controlling your behavior and telling you what to do. And the ancestral structures that I'm referring to have built up around those institutions to support them. In some senses, it's like to reinforce and self-select, so to speak, for this domesticative current. And so the way that this shows up is just, we can literally look at it in terms of what we do to an animal on a farm. So we control its sexual behavior. I think that's a big one. We tell it when it can reproduce, when it can't reproduce. And if if it even can reproduce. We choose all of those things. Of course, there's outlying situations where animals will breed with each other, but in general, we're controlling that. We mm-hmm. control where they get to sleep and what they get to do, what plots of food they have access to, how many resources they get to have, what the rules and regulations are in order to allow them to survive. Because if they do something we don't want them to do, we kill them, or we confine them, or we put them in a different situation. So basically, we control that aspect of their lives. We start to slowly warp their biology in order to facilitate those changes more and more and more. So it's not just about changing the behavior. We change them biologically so that, in fact, the behaviors we want become easier to instill in the animal. And a big part of how we do that is through keeping the animal more juvenile, so to speak, for its whole life. So the term in biology is called neoteny, N-E-O-T-A-N-Y, and it means to keep an animal in a more juvenile state throughout its entire life so that they don't really fully mature into adults, because the juvenile of a species are easier to control. So, I mean, an easy example of that is, you know, a baby bear versus an adult bear. Right? Mm-hmm. Very different circumstances. So all of this stuff happens in the context of a domesticative technology being applied to a living creature. And all of that stuff, if you really start to look at it, is being done to us by governments, religions, and by these relatively contemporary ancestral structures. So it shows up in all those arenas. So wherever your view of sexuality and or your sexual capacity anyway has been influenced by these institutions, wherever your relationship to food, wherever your relationship to the gathering and hunting, so to speak, and I mean that in a contemporary sense, of resources, the way you perceive your role in the world, wherever that's being purposefully controlled and manipulated by these institutions to serve them, that's where the domesticative current is showing up in your life.
All right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And actually, there's another thing that I was thinking of that you might be able to add to this list. I'm thinking about advertisers. I think that advertising is a place where a lot of stuff comes from. And social media, I think, is a huge place where we could look to where this domesticative current is very strong, I would say.
Totally, dude. Absolutely. So it's funny, I actually have a chapter in the book called Ad Free.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Because advertising absolutely is doing this on a multitude of levels. And the thing is that even advertising in a broader sense. So here's another example is a lot of people are playing games. They're basically playing a game of life, so to speak, that they have not consciously chosen the rules of. Right. Mm-hmm. So most people are playing a game that's been handed to them, whether that's as the social media game, whether that's the economic game, the rat race, as it were, whether it's the game of social status and social structure. People are playing this game. They're stuck in these relative social structures and social hierarchies, and they're trying to, in a sense, win the game. So when that happens, it's literally you are a cog, you are the fuel of a structure that is domesticating you so that it can continue to exist. So if we don't choose the rules of our own game and determine what that means to us, then we are, in a sense, playing into this domestication. So it shows up truly in a fantastic amount of ways. Even from the way that most people view their own bodies, for example, because a lot of the way that people view their own bodies these days is based off of how the medical institution describes the human body. So a lot of people perceive their bodies as doctors describe them, right? That is an interesting thing because, again, we are, and I'm not, and this is not about the correctness or incorrectness of doing so, to be accurate. It's only talking about the fact that we're talking about an authority that has an invested interest in keeping you subjugated to them for whatever set of reasons, and that the way now we perceive ourselves physically is through their lens. So it's really a difficult work to be able to tease apart these domesticating ideals in our lives. And I think that in a lot of ways, there are multiple elements to dealing with this. Do you want to talk about some of those? Or
yeah, I would love to. I was thinking that it might be a good idea to head over and take a bibliomancy break real quick, if that sounds good to you, though.
Sure, absolutely.
Awesome. Hey, what's up? I'm Luxa.
And I'm Josh. Are you looking for a chill place to hang out online and chat about chaos magic, occultism, witchcraft, and more? Are you hoping to learn and share your knowledge and experience in a place that is welcoming to folks of all different backgrounds and identities?
If so, check out the Green Machine Discord server, home of the Green Mushroom Project and Administrism. Our growing community of chaotes, occultists, sorcerers, witches, and weirdos has all kinds of fun and interesting things going on. From chats and rituals to workshops, clubs, and more, there's a lot of cool opportunities to get involved.
Sounds great, Luxa. How can folks find us?
Well, for now, we're keeping things pretty small as we grow, so we're not advertising on any of the Discord services that do that. But folks can hit me up, and I will send them a link. You can reach me at luxoccultpod@gmail.com, or you can find me on Instagram at luxoccultpod.
Fuck yeah!
Fuck yeah. All right, fuck yeah indeed. Hey, what's up? It's me, Luxa, from the future. I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. We're going to be returning to my conversation with Ramon Castellanos in just a little while to hear about how what he refers to as the domesticating current shows itself in our lives and what we might do to engage with more of our own wildness. But now, it's time for the episode within the episode. I spoke with Flood from XV Planis, as I said, another fine show here on the Green Mushroom Podcast Network, about some of the things that he and his paranormal investigation team will be getting into this summer. It's wild stuff. Flood also lets me know about a new project that he is starting that I can't wait to take part in. And there's so much going on in the news concerning the phenomena and disclosure and the rest of it. I am confident this is not the last we will be hearing from Flood as he continues to investigate all of these strange and wild things. Well, let's get into it here. We missed all that good cat content earlier, but that's okay.
There's a lot of cat energy going on around here.
Yeah, that's right. There's a lot of cat vibes here. All right. Well, today, my guest once again is Flood from the XV Planis podcast and more. It's not just a podcast anymore. We've got all kinds of things going on. And that's one of the things that we're here to talk about tonight.
Hi. Thank you again so much for having me. Always a pleasure to hang out with you, Luxa.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much for returning. So I kind of teased in the last episode that you've got some crazy plans for the summer. Could you tell me a little bit about what you have in store for yourself and the team?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, if any of y'all have been listening to me, you know that this this podcast was always kind of like or XV Planets, the podcast itself, was always a bit of a byproduct of an actual journey of exploration. You know, we went out and attempted to do some quote unquote ghost hunting once and had phenomenal results. And then we just kept going out and kept going out. And if you've been listening to the show for the last few years, you notice that the tone of it is kind of shifting and our focus is actually shifting as well. There's going to be a little bit of an evolution happening with the show as we move forward this particular year, because there is a kind of a grander theme and hypothesis that I'm developing right now, which I've spoken with you about off air, but I'm not going to get into it here until I actually nail all of this down in cement. But XV Planis is going through an evolution, and another side effect of that is that we are growing. Currently, I am packing up the Black Lodge, the studio where all of this insanity happens, and I'm about to move down south a little bit closer to home to be closer to family and also to a lot closer to many haunted places. I mean, if you go south, you're in Florida. You know how it is. You throw a rock, you hit something haunted.
Yeah, there's all kinds of shit around here for sure.
And with that growth, that means that I'm going to start heading up a Gulf Coast or Southeastern XV Planis team. And then Walker, Meg, and Sonny, who are going to be remaining up here in North Carolina, are going to carry on the East Coast team. So the XV Planis concept and family is now growing beyond the borders of just a small group of friends hanging out. We're really developing this into a new type of paranormal investigation team. And I mean, if I play my cards right and things go well and we can get some smarter people in, hopefully we can start veering into legitimate research on some of this stuff rather than just, you know, going out to chase ghosts and UFOs. Let's bring some real science into it, you know?
All right. Fuck yeah. Yeah, I love that idea. So you told me that you had some ideas for some different formats for the show, one of which I was pretty excited about. Do you want to go into that a little bit?
Yeah, you want to talk about that?
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. Okay. All right. For anyone out there who has ever been a fan of Art Bell and Coast to Coast AM, don't y'all miss that? Because I miss it. I mean, Lux, you and I talked about
this. It was
this.
So fun. It was so fucking surreal to listen to that shit super early in the morning as I was like getting ready to open the place where I was working. It was very fun.
It makes those late hour shifts so much more bearable. And anybody who's worked third shift or opening shift, we all know Art Bell was there for us when we needed him the most. But one of the things that I really missed about it was when he would do his open line segments, right? So you would have Art, maybe you'd have a guest or not, but he would always pick one or two subjects to focus on, and then the rest of the lines were just open.
You got to meet your fellow audience members.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And it was always a wild card thing. You never knew who was going to come on. You would have conspiracy theorists followed by homemakers, followed by
people claiming to be government agents or like all kinds of stuff. Yeah.
Werewolves. I just went back and listened to the Art Bell tape vault, and there was a great one on werewolves. And
I love it.
Holy hell.
Fuck yeah. Oh, God.
Yeah, no, it's just so good. But yeah, I miss that spirit and that kind of lighthearted version of it, you know, and I kind of want to bring that back. So sometime this year, what I'm hoping to do is kind of kick off a monthly, and if it goes well, we'll do it bi-weekly, kind of a call-in show. And I think we'll probably do it through StreamYard. We're still working on the logistics of this and how this is all going to go work, actually function in a live setting. But yeah, it's a type of energy and a type of connection to your audience that I think podcasting lacks. And while I would never want it to be the focal point of my show, I think it's just a blast to do something like this, because as you know, I've been doing the Patreon series, which is Transmissions from the Void, and it's all just one-on-one conversations about other people's paranormal experiences, which has been incredibly enlightening and moving at times and terrifying at others. And as I've been having all of these conversations with these amazing people, that thought kept coming back to me. I'm like, why in the hell am I not doing this live? And why am I not like lining up three or four people in a row? So you know what? That's what we're going
to
do.
Yeah, I'm so excited. Listening to that kind of stuff back in the day, I think, is one of the things that really probably did inspire me to start podcasting. And so it's really exciting to, you know, think to that that's kind of coming back. So yeah, hell yeah.
Yep. And you can bet your ass that you will be co-hosting with me on occasion. I certainly hope so.
I am so looking forward to that. Yes, we've discussed this, and I will be honored to be a host or guest host, I should say, on such a show.
Yeah, I have no idea when this is going to kick off. I mean, obviously, this is going to happen to happen after the relocation that I'm going through right now. So probably sometime this fall, we'll maybe kick this off. It might be a great way to kick off spooky season, to be honest.
Fuck yeah. Well, I love it. We'll have to keep people up to date about that. And people can follow you on Instagram and the places. And I will give a heads up about that, too, when that gets off of the ground.
Absolutely. I mean, you'll probably be within the first few episodes, so that'll be a great way to do some crossover stuff.
I'm so excited.
Yeah. So anybody out there is listening, like, put that little nugget of information in your head, because when this thing rears its ugly head or beautiful head or three-headed cryptozoological monstrosity, whatever it ends up being,
it's a variety of heads.
It's a variety of heads. We like that. Yeah. Kind of like the final creature from Evil Dead Rise, which was not all that great.
But yeah, when we get this thing kind of kicked off the ground, I, you know, put a little like, you know, seed in the back of your mind. Maybe you have some experiences or questions you might want to call in about. So fuck yeah.
Yeah, come and talk to us about it. Let us know what you've experienced. You know, I got to tell you, the most amazing thing about doing those interview series is finding out just how many people all around you have had strange and unusual experiences, but usually don't feel that comfortable sharing it with people.
Yeah.
And that was definitely like part of the idea of like, so Art Bell, even though he would ask tough questions and kind of press on his guests, he was always respectful and he always kept the conversation going and he always, you know, played it off the cuff. I want to talk to some werewolves. I want to talk to some vampires.
Absolutely. All the vampires and werewolves listening, please call in the StreamYard when we get that up and running. Okay, absolutely. So you've got other shit going on that's going to be happening sooner than that, though. I know you've got the relocation you already mentioned, but you've got some other stuff involving a god helmet, an area over by Skinwalker Ranch. Like, yeah. There's some other crazy shit going on. So would you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. Okay. So one of the steps of evolution that XV Planis is going through this year is I've started to take a look at the myriad of phenomena that I've had the opportunity to experience over the last few years. And I'm starting to unhook myself from labels, ghosts, UFOs, aliens, et cetera, et cetera. And personally, I'm starting to lean more into Jacques Vallée territory, which is it's all a bit of a psychic mirror that you are witnessing a phenomenon, but it is only going to be able to show itself in a way that you can comprehend that, you know, won't melt your brain. That's personally, I think that's where it's going. But we're actually going to test that. And we're going to head out to Uinta Basin, not Skinwalker Ranch proper, because they have not invited me on yet. But you better believe I'm gonna push on that one eventually. And we're going to run a few experiments, some consciousness experiments, meditation experiments, and a God helmet experiment in an effort to see if we can trigger all the different types of phenomena that happen in the Uinta Basin at one time. Now, for those of your listeners who are unfamiliar with it, Uinta Basin, large basin in Utah. It's where the infamous Skinwalker Ranch is. And this place is known for being a paranormal melting pot, which is why we have such an interest going there. So you don't just get poltergeist activity and you don't just get weird lights in the sky. You also get cryptids. You get portals opening up. You have
all manner of craziness. And honestly, this is a place where the U.S. government has sent people to study. Like, it's not that this is just a bunch of, like, fables. Like, this has been studied in a very conscious, like, grounded way, and it's been very interesting. So, yeah, there's something weird happening there.
Yeah. I mean, Robert Bigelow owned the place for upwards of almost 15 years and worked with the government. All right, so he started the National Institute of Discovery Sciences. I love going off on this tangent. Please, you shut me down if you need to.
Oh, no, so, I like this tangent. Go ahead.
Okay, all right. So Robert Bigelow, billionaire. This guy has more money than any of us could possibly know what to do with. He got his money by creating a budget in suites, made billions off of that, decides to throw all of his excess money into UFO research and discovery sciences. So he opens Bigelow Aerospace.
Which I'm sure his heirs were super into.
Right. And then he also opens the National Institute for Discovery Sciences. And shortly after he opens with these, he starts getting contracts with the government for, you know what, I don't know what for. We honestly don't know yet. But around the same time, he catches wind of this strange place out in Utah where all sorts of weird stuff happens, the Sherman Ranch, a.k.a. Skinwalker Ranch. He ends up buying this place, and he studies this thing for 15 years. And you remember when I said that XV Planis is going a little bit of an evolutional step this year, and how I'm trying to kind of step away from all of the labels that people put on the phenomenon. Bigelow has spent more time, more money into all of this stuff than any of us combined could possibly do. And after 15 years of studying this place, he sells a ranch. He sells off Bigelow Aerospace to the government. He breaks down the National Institute for Discovery Sciences and then proceeds to put all of his money into the Bigelow Institute for Consciousness Studies. And for me, that's a pretty big tell. And that's why, given all of the different type of phenomena that happens in that area and the fact that I'm kind of unshackling myself from these archaic descriptions of what this stuff is that we know from our past, because let's face it, we don't know. We don't know what any of this crap is. I want to go out there with a completely empty brain, but with the understanding that what's probably happening out there in all its very different forms is the exact same thing. It just matters who's looking. So that's essentially what we're going out there to try. So if I'm lucky, we will see a Bigfoot, probably have poltergeist activity, and then I'll get abducted by aliens, and you people will never hear from me again.
So for people that aren't familiar with this God Helmet technology, could you go into that a little bit?
Yes, absolutely. So the God Helmet was originally called the Shiva Helmet. And it was created by Dr. Michael Persinger. And basically what it does is it's a headset that you attach to the top of your dome. And it's got these panels on it that manipulate the electromagnetic frequencies that are running through, around, and into your brain. And what the God helmet is supposedly does is alter those electromagnetic frequencies in a way that would somewhat kind of replicate a religious or spiritual experience. You know, when people have these epic visions of I saw Jesus, I saw Moses, I saw Yahweh, you know, whatever. The goal of this helmet was to try to facilitate those things and figure out if these manifestations are more internal than external. And I always found that to be pretty fascinating. And I've seen other paranormal researchers use it in various different ways, usually applied to doing other types of, well, modern investigation methods like the Estes method or using spirit boxes, things like that. But what we want to do is actually switch it over to a meditation experiment. So we're going to have a group of people, and each one of the people in this group is going to be meditating and focusing all of their will, their thought, their intent, and the question of please show yourself in very specific types of phenomena. So we'll have one person in the meditation circle that is solely focusing on the concept of cryptids or bizarre, strange animal life that should not exist here. We have somebody else who's solely focusing on the concept of poltergeist activity. We got somebody else who's only thinking about UFOs and so on and so forth. And then you're going to have one person in the center who's going to be strapped up to a God helmet with some variations on certain types of electromagnetic frequencies going in that I've been kind of mapping out for the last few months. And we're going to couple with that a few other things that I'm not going to talk about on air. We'll talk about those later. But the goal is to collectively use a group consciousness, and essentially you can call this a ritual because it very much is, and try to focus everyone's intent on one type of phenomenon while the person in the center will focus their intent on basically being a funnel point, pulling all of that consciousness energy into one point and then funneling through the God helmet.
Okay, so everybody in this circle is sort of going to be like concentrating on the same thing at once, like show yourself as a Bigfoot or whatever, and then the person, the receiver that's wearing the God helmet will be open to that experience?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, well, cool. Each individual in this group will be focusing on only one particular type of phenomena while the person next to him will be thinking of another.
Oh, okay. Are you going to try it where everybody sort of does it together and so you can see if you can like select for which one together?
Actually, nope. It's kind of weird the way that all of this panned out, because if you look at the different types of phenomena that happen out in that area, the team that's coming out there with me, each one of them have their specific interests. So it's almost like it was lined up to be.
Okay.
Because, you know, Meg is absolutely nuts about Sasquatch, cryptid, stuff like that. You know, Walker's going to be out there. He's very much into the poltergeist type of activity. I mean, so we've got the right amount of people lined up for it.
Okay, that makes sense. So it's sort of like, yeah, in terms of like experimental design, it might make sense to get a bunch of like sort of blank slates and see if everybody could kind of do. But from a sort of more ritual standpoint, it makes sense to play to everybody's strengths and like, yeah, and interests and everything. That's really cool.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're just going to see what happens. You know, and anytime that we go out and we do these things, we're not antagonistic, which is usually when you hear about things going horribly awry. We really just want to go out there and be like, hey, we already know that you show yourself in very many different forms to many different people. Let's try it all at once. I have no idea what to expect from this. I'm just kind of running with my instincts off of this, and we'll see where it takes us. But I do think that there's something to that. And if you look at the common conversation that's going on just within the UFO, UAP community, and as well as some deeper... we're seeing a return to parapsychology studies recently, which I am extremely excited about because we need to get that aspect back into it. We're seeing a lot of people veer away from more vague descriptions and start leaning into consciousness studies. It seems to be where everybody's going with it. And I got to tell you, it kind of feels right, you know?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Fuck yeah.
I do hope I get abducted, though.
Yes, the idea of the abduction experience is something that we've talked about for sure.
Yeah, I'm not shy.
But yeah, so kind of switching gears real quick, you mentioned that there's like a lot of haunted places in the South where you're going to be going. Is there some place in particular that you're most excited to visit or to explore?
Yeah, actually, there is quite a few. Having the opportunity to have more steady access to some of the locations that I first ever had paranormal experiences at when I was younger. It seems like it's time to return to some of those and maybe actually gain access in a completely new and different way and explore those. So there's a lot of stuff from my hometown I'm eager to get back into and hopefully kind of come back around full circle with that. There are just endless amounts of historical places peppered all through the South. However, one in particular that I'll share with you, if anybody has like Prime, anything like any streaming service, this documentary usually shows up every once in a while. And it's a flick called The House in Between. And this documentary is on a supposedly paranormally active house that is somewhere in Mississippi, supposedly near Florence. And it's kind of like a mini Skinwalker. They've had a little bit of everything there. So it's been strange shapes that are not quite humanoid lurking in the forest. They've had UFOs pop up. They've had poltergeist activity in the house. So I'm eager to get to that one and essentially perform the same experiments we'll be doing in Uinta. See what happens. And of course, I'm dying to get back over to Florida. I want to go back to Casadaga again, and I definitely have to go check out St. Augustine.
Yeah, St. Augustine is the fucking tits. I love that place.
Yeah, we're going to make that happen a few times over the course of the next year. It's definitely on the list, and I've been linking up with some people out there. So we have some things in the work, but nothing I can really announce on the Florida coast just yet.
Yes, it's a very cool place to visit and everything. Yeah, I understand that there's been some sad stuff with how tourism has affected the local economy and everything, too. So I don't...
Well, I haven't heard about that. Is it getting bad over there?
I guess there's been, people that, grew up there are getting, bought out because of, how expensive, Airbnbs are, taking over everything and shit. So, which is sad. So, but yeah, that sucks. But it is a really cool place. I can kind of get why that's happening, tourist-wise. There's, all these cool museums. There's, a fucking pirate museum and an old-ass fort and, a distillery and a bunch of good restaurants and shit. There's a lot of cool things. So, yeah.
I know. Yeah, but the real trick here is just go ahead and move 10, 15 miles inland because the coast is going to be at your front door in another 10 years. So
there you go. Yeah, we've been
look
talking
at me
about...
always the optimist, you know.
Yeah, we've been talking about relocating north because of more political reasons and stuff. But yes, we'll see how it goes. We'll see how
it's a
weird goes.
Climbing out there in multiple ways in one. Yeah. Anyway, but yeah, there's a lot of weird, exciting changes going on. And, you know, between the call-in show and some of the southbound investigations I had planned, I certainly hope that you'll be able to join us in person and certainly on the show a few times in the near future, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm always happy to visit the Black Lodge. Fuck yeah. And yeah, I would love to tag along. I've been wanting to go and it just hasn't worked out yet. So one of these days.
God, if I was, 10 years ago, if I was better on my Black Lodge reverse speak, I would have been able to say that the Black Lodge welcomes you in reverse, but I've lost it. Yeah. I just, that is a skill that you never,
get
to use that much.
Say it real clear and I'll play it backwards when I produce this.
The Black Lodge welcomes you.
All right. Fuck yeah, I love it. Well, Flood, thank you so much for taking the time to hang out with me this evening. Is there anything that you want to mention that I didn't ask about, or do you have any questions that you want to ask me or anything like that?
No, because I will say that all questions I had for you, you filled us in on just on this last episode. For anybody who listens to me, Luxa popped by and talked a little bit about what's happening at Babylon Rising. I'll be running that again on the next episode as well. I'm crossing my fingers that I can make it, but I don't think it's going to happen this year. Oh, and you can expect some pretty big public events on the East Coast coming up this fall. We just recently partnered with the Spirits of Wake Forest Tour here in North Carolina. And there's going to be some, if I understand correctly, we're going to do some charity public ghost hunts as well as some educational tours around town and go into some spooky places that nobody has ever had the opportunity to get into.
Well, that sounds really cool. Fuck yeah.
Yeah. Far out, solid, and right on, right?
Yeah. Far out, solid, and right on indeed. Fuck yeah. All right. Hell yeah, dude. Well, so where can people find your stuff?
You can find us at XV Planis on all of the social media horseshits. We're on Twitter. We're on Instagram. We're on Facebook. See, this is why I love hanging out with you. The chef and me can come out and I start cursing like a sailor. I'm a little more uptight in my show, folks. yeah, you can find us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all that stuff. XV Planets on Patreon. And there is, actually, if you just go to xvplanets.com, it's only a placeholder page right now, but it does act as a hub for kind of keeping track of everything that's happening right now. Hopefully that website will be full up and running by the end of this summer, and you can expect a ridiculous amount of content on there.
All right. Well, fuck yeah, dude. Well, we will be looking forward to hearing more from you about all these exciting things you've got going on.
I can't wait to hear back from you after Babylon Rising. You should come back on the show and tell us how it went.
Yeah, I would love to.
All right. You got a deal.
All right. Fuck yeah, dude. Well, I hope you have a good night. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me, Luxa. Always, always a blast hanging out with you. We'll talk
to
you soon.
Yeah, you too, dude. You too. All right, fuck yeah. Thanks so much to Flood. I'm really excited to hear about how all of this goes and who guest hosts on the Paranormal Call-In Show. I wonder what he'll end up naming it. Ghost to Ghost AM? Gods, that's probably taken. Oh wait, shit, this is what they call the Halloween specials on the old Coast to Coast show. That's fun, fuck yeah. Okay, well, keep an eye on xvplanets.com and follow Flood on Instagram and the other social media stuff to see what he has going on as the summer progresses on. All right, before we get back into my conversation with Ramon Castellanos, let's do a quick Green Mushroom Project update. So this episode came out a little bit later than I had hoped. I was originally planning to release it on the 23rd when we conducted the 11th iteration of 23 Bibliomancy Experiment. We'll be conducting the 12th one on the 23rd of July. So if you're into it, grab the book that wants to participate and some D10s and join us for the fun. We also have an electronic version of the D10s if you're not a big enough nerd to own polyhedral dice. That's totally cool. You're still welcome, regardless of how nerdy you are. So let's see here. On Friday, the 7th of July, this year of Our Lady, 2023, I'll be hosting a special Fungal Friday chat in which I will give a repeat of the Hyper Sigil workshop that I ran at Babylon Rising recently. We'll go over some of the theory and look at some historical examples of it, and then folks can begin work on their own hyper sigils. So grab the art supplies or whatever creative apparatus that is calling to you and join us for that. We're also going to be offering some intro to chaos magic classes on the server. We're having a whole little series put together of just kind of getting back to the basics. We've got a lot of new friends who have strong backgrounds in things like Thelema or other types of Western occultism or other things, but just don't really have a whole lot of grounding in chaos magic. And so we're really excited to be doing some skill shares and other types of workshops along those lines as well. All kinds of fun stuff in the works. We recently had our first 24 cinema score in which we watch old horror movies and comment on them. We watched The Undertaker and His Pals, and I have to say, top-notch. top-notch cinema there. No notes. So if you're into taking part in any of these things, come hang out with us on the Green Machine Discord server. You can get a link to that by emailing me or Dave from Unearthing Paranormalcy or Yara from Administrism, and one of us will hook you up with a link. All right, well, let's get back into it here for the rest of my conversation with Ramon Castellanos, who is about to take a quick bibliomancy break before going into the ways that we might fight the current of domestication. Cheers. I was listening to you describe this force of domestication, and it's reminding me a little bit of what Discordians sometimes call the force of Greyface, this kind of organizing force, the opposite of chaos, which is very funny. So hail Eris, and let's head over and take a bibliomancy break.
Okay, sure.
All right. So, Ramon, do you have a question for the Oracle?
A question for the Oracle. So what would be one of the most auspicious aspects of the book to bring up now?
Okay. Oh, Eris, please tell us, what would be one of the most auspicious aspects of the book to bring up now? And what's the book called again?
In Praise of the Wild Spirit.
In Praise of the Wild Spirit. Okay, fuck yeah. All right, so we got a couple of twos here. What's it going to be? The Satanic Bible by Anton Salazar LaVey. Let me find it real quick here. All right. I have located this text. Oh, Eris, please point us in the direction of the most auspicious topic from In Praise of the Wild Spirit that we should bring up next. Cannot be, which shineth as a flame in the midst of your places, and reigneth among you as a balance of life. Okay, thanks, Eris. Cheers. I hope that was helpful.
Yeah, actually, okay. Very, very interesting. I think it lines up with what I was thinking about bringing up. Yeah.
All right. Fantastic. So let's get into some of those specifics that you were mentioning before we did the bibliomancy break, and maybe some of the stuff that the bibliomancy break pointed you into.
Oh, my mind's like torn in two different places now. Okay. Let's see. So the specifics, right? So if we want to be able to recognize this domesticative current and work with it in a way that's intelligent, I think it's really smart to have what I would call a foreign policy. And so what I mean by foreign policy is that in some senses, you are a sovereign creature. So that's one of the aspects we're talking about here with wildness, is that that's something I really learned from wolves, is that wolves were sovereign beings who you really couldn't tell them what to do. You couldn't really control them. At the most, you could reason with them. You could try to explain what you wanted through whatever means of communication you had. And then if they felt that it was appropriate and in their best interest, then they would comply. So that's what I have taken to doing with some of the big aspects of domestication that are pretty much inescapable. And that means developing a policy for how you deal with these outside influences. And if it's not conscious, if it's not consciously chosen by you, it's unconsciously imposed upon you. So in a lot of ways, for me, the process of relating more to wildness, which again is a term that I really want people to kind of know that I'm referring to more mythologically, right? It's difficult to be literal about that when we live inside of a domesticated society. But nonetheless, what I'm talking about here is if we're looking for wildness, we have to be able to become more conscious and aware of that which is robbing us of our wildness and our sovereignty and how we want to deal with it. So an example that I might give in this case is the law, for example. So there are laws in place that control behavior, and they're pretty much the rules that you're allowed to live by in the broader sense of things. And if you break the law, then you go to jail, right? And basically you're, another layer of your freedom, so to speak, at least on an external level, is stripped from you. So when it comes to the law, I'm pretty much a pretty law-abiding citizen in most cases, outside of certain contexts of, you know, the working with plant medicines in certain contexts. But, you know, it's because that's a part of my foreign policy. It's a conscious choice for me. I don't simply think that the laws are correct for their own sake. I think that a lot of laws are very arbitrary constructs. But I still adhere to them because it's in my best interest to do so. and that same idea could apply in any number of ways. So that's one idea. Another one would be to have an anti-domesticative technology, right? So if we're looking at a domesticative technology, then what we really need in today's culture, if we're interested in doing this work, is more of a rewilding technology or a wildness technology. And what does that even look like, right? Because that's something they were kind of having to create on the fly in order to deal with a set of circumstances that we as individuals don't want to deal with. So in some senses, this rewilding technology is in the realm of pioneering at the moment, of innovation, I would say, funny enough. because, yeah, I mean, who's to say what even does or doesn't work? But from my experience and from what I have seen, there's a few things people can do. One is to seek out wild places. So places that are not underneath the control of some institution. And that means nature, generally speaking, and real nature, not necessarily, you know, the patch of dirt in front of your house, even though if that's the best you can do, hey, that's the best you can do. But, you know, getting out in the wilderness somehow, if you can, or at least into forested areas or even the ocean, because the ocean is a wilderness experience. And so being able to do that, another layer would be to seek out wild allies, right? So creatures and or spirits that are wild. And, you know, cats are actually great for that. A lot of people don't know this, but cats are actually not fully domesticated creatures. That's why they're so different from dogs. That's why they might not respond to their name, even though they know they have a name. That's also why they hunt on such a continuous basis, or at least a part of why, right? Mm-hmm. And that's also why they display this aloofness to humans. Actually, wolves and cats are really similar.
Okay, interesting. I've actually used my cats to learn things about magic from, so that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, that's because cats actually came into human society through their own choice.
Sure.
Yeah. We didn't actually do it to them so much as they did it to themselves, because they liked what we were offering and that we had rats, right? So they came to live with us more than we brought them in originally. And so cats are great to study for wildness cues. So, you know, you follow a cat around for a day and do everything the cat does.
That's exactly what I did.
Yeah, exactly. You would learn a lot about wildness, including like their lounging around qualities, which in some senses is a subversive act in mm-hmm. the face of something that's trying to commodify you. Mm-hmm. So that's an aspect, but also wild spirits, for example, being able to commune with spirits that are inherently connected more to wild currents, and even our hunter-gatherer ancestors themselves, and being able to connect into them because they can teach us a lot about what that means. Then seeking out wild experiences, so experiences that are aligned more with a wild current. You know, an example of that, and I'm just throwing out one that popped into my head. It could literally be like an orgy, for example, if that's what you wanted to do, right? If that was like a part of your jam,
sure.
And that's because it flies in the face of what the domesticating currents are telling you sexuality is supposed to look like, for example.
Sure, and in terms of very literally, our domestication technology is very much about controlling the force of sex, right? And so I think that's. You could look to that as being something that could be a major thing for people, for sure.
Totally, yeah. Or, you know, if you know how to like to move into a space of like deeply intense, full body, ecstatic orgasms, right? Something like that. If you can do that, I think deep ecstatic states absolutely are a rewilding technology, right? Or you know. In this context, they're more than that, right? I'm not. I don't want to pigeonhole those technologies into just this, but
they could be used that way. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Then you just getting out into experiences which connect you to this deep inner sense of sovereignty and control of your own destiny, so to speak, right? And maybe control is the wrong word, but more like governance, the ability to mm-hmm. govern one's life according to one's own imperative. So those are a few basic ideas. There's a lot more that I talk about in the book, but those are some aspects that someone might approach if they're wanting to do this work. Also, avoiding the middle, I would say, is an aspect of this. So humans, so this actually comes back to being herded, right? So there's an aspect of the book, a big aspect of the book that I talk about, which is becoming, it's called becoming unherdable, right? So human beings, we are, especially in the context of domesticative currents, like to herd, and we are herded in any number of ways. You can see herding in small ways when we go to like a grocery store or whatever, and we're stuck into a line. We're being corralled. I mean, and it's used in that way, and it makes sense, right? I'm not saying
sure.
Go smash down the line, but it's a type of corralling, and human beings are corralled consistently in today's world. They are herded. And they are herded by some of the things that we have already talked about, advertising, for example. They're herded by the unconscious adoption of cultures. So an interesting example of that could be Instagram culture, right? So a person jumps onto Instagram and maybe they don't know much about Instagram. And then they start to pick up on an unconscious culture around Instagram. And then they start to fit into that culture. Well, that's a type of herding. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I have this imperative of becoming unherdable. One of the things that you notice with herds is that they tend to gravitate towards the middle. You look at crowds that gather around something and people tend to move towards the middle. Whereas the outliers off to the sides are, it becomes more sparse out to the sides. So that's a little interesting thing that I've noticed. So wherever someone is kind of orientating towards the average because of an unconscious compliance, so to speak, that's where I'm talking about avoiding the middle. And becoming unherdable has a bunch of other qualities to it too. And that's what I can leave there. Oh, you know what? I'll talk about one more aspect. And that's magic. I think that magic is in many ways something that moves against the domesticating current, which is one of the reasons why I think it is continuously pulled out of modern society more and more, because magic is inherently unpredictable. There's this idea that I talk about called the volcanism of magic. And I talk about it like that because when we're around volcanoes, you really notice this raw, new wild force that is creating in the moment. It is truly something that is being birthed right there and then. And I think magic is a lot like that, because real magic, when you're connected to the currents of real magic, things start to happen and possibilities are created that didn't exist before. So I think the domestication of anything wants predictability, and it wants to control things in order to reduce uncertainty. And in a lot of ways, magic works with the mystery of uncertainty in some senses, the mystery of possibility and probability. So I think that magic is another very good rewilding technology.
Okay, I fucking love that. And I agree. I think that there's a lot of things that we can do in our magical practice that we could point to as being like rewilding or going against this domesticating current. I'm wondering, though, is the domesticating current itself its own type of magic? Because I think that there's places we can see, like within, like, let's say selective breeding, for example, like if we're breeding tomatoes or whatever, like we'll get these breaks, these like cultivated varieties, these cultivars that all of a sudden have different color tomatoes than any of the other ones that we were growing before. Like we'll get these surprises because there is still elements of randomness involved in like these genetic components and stuff. So I'm wondering, I think there's something interesting in how these things are playing together here.
Sure. Yeah. I love that you brought that up. So, I mean, I guess it depends on your worldview, right? There's some times where I simply talk about magic the way that I just did in order to give people something tangible to grab onto. Because mm-hmm. at another level, I think about everything as magic fundamentally, right? So I even think of rationality as a type of magic fundamentally that accomplishes certain things inside the world, right? It's a way to exert influence. I think of magic fundamentally as a type of way to exert influence. And there are multiple layers to that. And it kind of becomes, for me, a little bit semantic of what is and isn't magic, right?
Sure.
And it becomes a little bit difficult to talk about in a way that's useful. Of course, a part of that is the limitations of language and even the limitations of the English language. But yeah, sure, we could say that domestication is a type of magic, especially if you think about technology and and technology's connection to the beings who taught humans about technology in the first place, And some people connect technology as a whole to the magical gods, right? To the gods that teach the mysteries of magic, etc. Yeah. You know, so from that perspective, we could say that domestication is that. What I was gonna bring up, though, and this kind of ties in regards to the bibliomancy break, was the mention of balance, right? And so I think that wildness as a whole often gets caught up in the notion that it is inherently always unpredictable. And I don't think that's true at all. Nor do I think that wildness is without order, because we definitely see order in the wild world, right? No one has to tell the sun to move on a 24-hour, or for us to move around the sun in a 24-hour cycle, right? Or the rotation of the planets, or the fact that the birds, they wake up at the crack of dawn and then will carry out their schedule with certain regularness, certain routine, and then come back and go to sleep and do their thing again and again. So, you know, order in and of itself is not against wildness. There is wildness in the natural world. Mm-hmm. It's a part of the book that I call wild order. And so it's not just about chaos. It's that domestication is trying to limit and constrain your sense of possibilities. And even you, and not even just your sense of it, but your actual possibilities in order to commodify you. That's really what is at the core of domestication. So I don't necessarily think that in order to connect to wildness, we're only seeking out, that we only need to seek out chaotic experiences, or even think that wildness is defined by chaos, because I don't think that's true. And I think that that's something that is used in order to scare humans away from wildness, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. That, you know, it's like, that's the devil over there. Be afraid of that, you know? Yeah, totally.
Yeah, you could actually see it in the story of Little Red Riding Hood. So it's very interesting. Wolves are actually, if you look at fairy tales, they're often symbolic of the wild world. They're symbolic of the wilderness, whereas dogs are symbolic of civilization and domestication because, well, dogs are domesticated wolves, right? So that is a very clear example that we can see of a creature that we were deeply connected to in the past. And some wolves stayed with humans and became dogs, and some have stayed in the wild. And so Little Red Riding Hood is an example of that. The story starts off with the little girl, and she's in her town, her little village. And the village is bright, and it's happy, and the birds are singing, and it's safe, and everything is good. And then she goes into the wilderness, and all of a sudden it gets dark and scary, and you don't know what's in the shadows. And the wolf, the scary wolf, is hidden somewhere out there wanting to eat, you know? So that same idea actually applies in a lot of stories that have wolves in them. And I think that a lot of that has to do with that bifurcation that we've had of moving towards the agriculture-based domesticative current as a society, and the unpredictability as we perceive it that is in the wild world. But I don't think that inherently, I mean, it's kind of self-evident that if you look in the wilderness, you see order, you see routine, and you see regularity. It's not purely chaotic, if that makes sense.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think in some ways what we are caught in with the domesticative current is more and more machine-like. It's trying to be more mechanical. And that's one of the layers of it that is really evident to me. And in order to do that, we are trying to continuously remove from it the ability for errors, for example, the ability for something to come and ruin the machinations of this large machine. And that's what we strip out. And that's what we also try to fix, quote unquote, or lobotomize. And that we also try to constrain. And all of this has to do with the intentionality. It's why is this domesticative current? What is taken over, basically? Mm-hmm. Why is that the case? And, you know, we can come up with any number of reasons for it. But as far as I can tell, the world is going through a conversion campaign and has been going through a conversion campaign for, you know, a few thousand years now, where, in a sense, things are being terraformed to be more conducive to the changes that domestication is trying to instill. Gordon White, I'm sure you're familiar with Gordon White.
Yeah, he's an author and podcaster.
Yeah, he has a he likes to use the Firefly example for some of this, the movie Firefly. It, basically, the idea is a world without sin, where basically you have these elite people who are presenting themselves as benevolent because they want to remove all sense of unpredictability and any room for mistakes from the world. You know, and when you look at the original meaning of the word sin, it means to miss the mark, in a sense, to create an error, so to speak. Some might even say to make a mistake or to generate chaos, whatever. But those people are, and I say those people in the broadest sense possible, are invested into this world without sin to create this predictable machine. And in order to do that, the world's being converted continuously to make all of that easier. And that's what I perceive to be this domesticative current in the broadest sense.
Okay.
And so for us that are interested in moving in an opposite direction, basically it's about becoming more conscious, more aware of all of these layers of control and constraint that are being put into the world and why they're being put into the world, whose best interest is really at heart here, and what is it trying to serve? Who is it trying to serve? We might say, some might say that those would be humans, maybe institutions, maybe even beings from other dimensions that are interested in having the world move in this way. Who knows? But I personally just have felt very called in my life to move in a very different direction. And that's why I'm doing this work for people who are interested in doing that. I don't pretend that this is going to affect the mass population, because it probably won't. It's for people who have a deeper call to this sovereignty piece of things. And I have aspects that I could share that might be helpful, you know?
Fuck yeah. So people can check out In Praise of the Wild Spirit. So I was listening to you, you know, describe this, this idea of wildness and wilderness and wolves. And this comes up in the Bible too, you know, and the idea of sin, right? So I'm wondering, in a very sort of like big picture sense, to what extent is this drive towards domestication about our knowledge of death and our fear of it and our want for things to be predictable because we're afraid of death and or afraid of chaos because we're afraid of death? And this idea of like eating the fruit and having knowledge of good and evil, and we assume that's when you realize that you'll also die one day too. And so, yeah, there's some kind of interesting interchange here that I'm wondering if there's anything there for you as well.
Sure. Yeah. So one of the layers that I'm also going to talk about in the book is ancestor practice, because when you look, it's funny, but when you look at older traditional tribal cultures, there's a lot less fear of death because there's a lot more of a healthy relationship with death. There are entire cosmologies built around death. Death is understood as an aspect of life that you're continuously tapping into because most of these cultures have ancestral reverence. So death doesn't become this scary thing. It's more of an ally that is a part of the cycle of life, because if you're consistently tapping into ancestral spirits, you are literally tapping into the dead. And if you're working with the dead as allies, and you know, you do a lot of the things that people do with ancestral shrines, which if you notice a lot of traditional cultures around ancestral shrines, they're usually beautiful. And there's a reason for that. It's because death becomes more beautiful. It becomes something that you reinforce on a continuous basis as more beautiful, as helpful, as simply a part of the dance between life and death. So I think there are many layers to this question too. I also think that in some ways, the fear of death is directly related to the fear of life, and that the more afraid to be fully alive you are, the more afraid of death you are. So I don't actually think that is so much of a true thing for why we've ended up here per se, because I don't perceive wild humans to be as nearly as death phobic as we are as a society. And it is wild humans nonetheless who I guess fell into domestication, right? At some point. And I do think, I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, absolutely.
I honestly think, and this is a little bit more of a slightly more esoteric perspective, I honestly think that there are otherworldly influences that are impacting all of this. Who they are, what they are, etc. I have literally no idea. So I'm not like sitting over here and like conspiracy theory about it. It's the gray aliens or something like that. It's none of that, right? I have no clue. The reason that I say that is because when you look at the mythologies of all of this, you often see that these technologies that have become what they are were taught to us by spirits or otherworldly beings, almost without fail. And you often see beings involved in the creation of nations and city-states and some of the earliest signs of civilization. So, you know, I don't really, that's just an idea. I wouldn't argue it with somebody and say that it's for certainly it's that. It's a sense, right? And that's the best that I can say about it.
Okay, fuck yeah, thank you. So before I let you go, would you mind circling back and talking a little bit about the initiation into the Orisha tradition that you mentioned earlier on? Because that sounded very interesting.
Yeah, well, so when you get initiated into the Orisha tradition, you're often given a name, right? And that name, in a sense, do you read fiction? I'm sure you read fiction, right?
Yes, yeah. I've been known to read fiction, absolutely.
Yeah, you know, in a lot of fiction based stories around fantasy and whatnot, there's this idea of a true name, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So when you get this name, it's something more akin to a type of true name, right? Because these languages, they are onomatopoeia, onomatopoeic, poetic is the word. In that their sound is the actual thing, right? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That the sound, it's kind of like the drip sound. We call the drip from a faucet that because it sounds that way.
Yeah, we would call like a punch pow or something like that. Yeah,
exactly. Right. So these languages, some of these languages that we think of as the spiritual languages of the world, like Sanskrit or the Yoruba language, they are more closely resonant with the actual thing that they describe, so to speak. And so this name that you're given is supposed to be a type of name that has a very potent impact in terms of what names do. And mine is a Solani Gwe, which means the king of the wild or the king of the wilderness, but more closely aligned with the king of the wild or the chief of the wild would be a different way of saying it. And I never paid attention to that at all growing up. It's only something that even in the last couple of years has actually been, I don't know, something that's popped into my awareness as possibly significant. I won't create a whole story around it or anything like that. Just that it seems to have been something that I kind of came here with for whatever reason.
That's really fucking beautiful. I love it, dude. Hell yeah.
Yeah, well, thanks. But yeah, so that's my piece about that. When I was initiated, when I was an infant, as you know, and given that name, and apparently that name has had something. because I've been pulled into this through my life experiences and through just a deep desire to understand wildness. And, you know, wildness can mean a lot of different things. You know, I really hope that people don't get the idea that I am talking about a very specific, narrow definition of wildness. If anything, I think that the specific and narrow is domestication. And wildness is diverse. There's a lot of diverse pathways that it can take. And I think that's a hallmark of it. So when I'm describing all of this stuff, it's not to try to put anyone into a box. If anything, it's to try to cast off the boxes that people have been put into, including my definitions of wildness as a whole and what that even means for human beings, right, in the 21st century. Because it can mean a lot of things. And I think that you have to choose that for yourself. Kind of the one thing I'll leave with, because I know we're getting up on our time here, if I can add one last layer.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, is you know, wolf dogs, I think, actually can teach modern humans a lot about how to dance with this wildness piece of things. Because a wolf dog is a mix between a wolf and a dog. And that ends up giving you an animal that has a very distinct and completely unique set of wild and domestic traits. And that's because genetics do not disperse in a living creature linearly, right? It's not linear. So, you know, if you have an African mother and a Japanese father and you have four kids, they're not all going to be a 50-50 split between...
Yeah, there's a lot of dice rolls that go into to genetic recombination. Absolutely, yeah.
Exactly. And we saw that firsthand with wolves and dogs. When people would take a wolf, a purebred wolf, and then mix it with a purebred dog, the breeders who were interested in commodifying that animal would often sell it in a percentage-based manner. So they would say, well, this is a 50% wolf dog because its dad was a wolf and its mom was a dog. So it's a 50-50 split. But the problem is that that's not really what happened, is that you would have a litter, and in that litter, you would have some animals that were more wolf-like in behavior and some that were more dog-like in behavior and some that were in between. But the interesting thing about that is that what that meant was completely relative, because what if its behavior was more dog-like, but its appearance was more wolf-like? What if it had the fear of humans that the wolf had, but the playfulness of the dog? And all these different, almost opposite qualities would mix in an animal, and you would get this unpredictable mix of an animal. And a lot of wolf dogs are more unpredictable than wolves or dogs, because wolves are actually highly predictable animals. You kind of know what they're going to do. So are dogs. Wolf dogs, on the other hand, are not very predictable because they have this inherent mix. They're like in between animals. In some ways, they're liminal. And so I think that in that way, that's what a lot of us that want to rewild are kind of playing with in today's world, kind of like becoming wolf dogs. Because in some senses, we have to develop our own sense of what wild and domestic traits we want to live with. So for me, for example, that might be right being a law-abiding citizen, for example, while also having any number of other traits that fly in the face of the domesticating current, right? Mm-hmm. And I choose that for myself. Yeah, so it's kind of like a mascot, so to speak, a power animal, one might say, that people can kind of relate to who want to do this work.
Fuck yeah, I love that. Well, Ramon, thank you so much for joining me. Is there anything that you would like to mention that I didn't ask about, or do you have any questions that you would like to ask me?
I guess I'd be curious about what your take of rewilding is, right? With what I've been talking about, what does that mean for you at this stage in your life, and how do you relate to it?
Okay, cool. Well, I think that I found a lot of parallels in some of what you were saying with this idea of like rewilding with a sort of notion of reconditioning. Like we have all this social conditioning that we receive, gender conditioning, all this other stuff, you know, telling us how to fit into all these boxes. And so this idea of approaching, some people call it deconditioning, but I'm of the opinion that one can't like decondition, only recondition, because you're sort of doing a new set of things. You're still like, you're still sort of under the auspices of the authority, perhaps, of like a semiotic set of understandings about things. Maybe totally. Would be a way of describing it.
100%.
But yeah. So yeah, I'm seeing a lot of parallels there for me. And I'm reminded too, in a lot of what Aidan Wachter and I had talked about in terms of like really looking at this stuff and really being very aware of it. And I really like the way that you've broken down this idea of like the current of domestication. And yeah, I think that you've given us a lot of interesting things to work with there. And I'm looking forward to checking out the book, and I'm sure everybody listening is as well.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'll definitely let you know if you want when I finish it and when it's out.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, let us know and we will let the listeners know.
Oh, well, thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. Lux.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah, hell I yeah, love, dude. I love, and I agree with what you said, by the way, earlier. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Hell yeah. All right. Well, Ramon, thank you so much for joining me today. This has been an absolute pleasure. Where can people find your work?
Yeah. So if they're interested in connecting with me, my website is called theancestralnow.com. And I do currently have a book out called The Ancestral Now, which can be found on all the places that people buy digital books.
All right. Fuck yeah. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Lux. Appreciate it. Also.
All right. Fuck yeah. Thanks so much to Ramon Castellanos.
Lots of cool and useful stuff to think about there for sure. You can find his work, including the book, The Ancestral Now, at theancestralnow.com. And check out my other conversation with him in episode 57 of this show. Also, don't forget to check out the other awesome podcasts available here on the Green Mushroom Podcast Network. We've got Administrism, Ad Hoc History, Grognostics, Primordia, Unearthing Paranormal Sea, and XV Planis. All of them very dope shit, so check it out. All right, some random thoughts to share with you all here. So Ramon mentioned the idea of feeling like there are these sort of big forces behind things, maybe extra-dimensional beings, or maybe the depictions of these forces are humanoids because as social creatures, that's how we most easily interact with, you know, things that are like us. Who knows? But looking at the concept through a slightly different lens, I'm reminded of the notion of ideas having people. I think a touchstone for this for a lot of folks might be the idea of like what a meme is, which as far as I'm aware was popularized and may have been introduced in the book The Selfish Gene by Richard Dawkins. So in a nutshell, the premise of the book and the main argument the author makes is that there is not some like grand design to the universe in terms of our place in it as animals. Rather, the systems that we see around us emerge as a result of mechanisms and choices based largely in self-interest or the continued existence of the thing making the choices. So life forms which persist and therefore continue to exist around us possess an inherent quality of acting in their own self-interest or selfishly. Dawkins takes this idea to a lot of places in the book. It's been like 15 years since I read it, so I don't remember everything. And I've heard that a lot of the arguments he makes don't stand up super well to the actual evidence that we've gathered in the field since the time it was written. But a sort of a Gödelian twist, if you will, a self-referential joke, perhaps, is that the notion of the selfish gene is itself a meme, and one which has persisted rather well. So there's an old saying, and I think this is Mark Twain, it sounds like some grandpa shit for sure, that a lie can travel halfway around the world before the truth even puts its shoes on. The power of a meme doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the veracity or accuracy or truth or, I don't know, fidelity of the information which it contains. And I think that this is a good thing to keep in mind. A meme can be looked at as being like a spirit or egregore. I believe Grant Morrison famously goes into this in regard to advertising in his lecture to DisinfoCon. I'll put a link to that in the show notes if you haven't checked it out before. It's sort of a classic. Anyway, ideas can have a sort of agency of their own, it seems. So Ramon talks about this idea of establishing a foreign policy, or we might call like healthy emotional and psychological boundaries surrounding how you'll deal with ideas or memes that you encounter is a wise thing to do. So just because an idea is coming at you all hard and hot and heavy, or just because it's telling you what you want to hear, doesn't mean that it's going to stick around or have your best interest at heart. So consider the source of information as well as the motivations people or media outlets might have for sharing it with you. And never stop asking questions. Stay curious. So if you like the show and you're into what I've got going on here, you can support me on Patreon. Making this thing is a pretty wild amount of work, especially just for one person, but it means a lot to me to be able to do it. Thank you so much to the people who are making that possible by give me on Patreon or buy me a coffee, and the people who are supporting the show by spreading the word. Tell your friends and your pet sitters about the show. Tell your barber, your butcher, and your grocer about it. Tell your coworkers and lovers and the person who glues rhinestones on your genitals about it. That's still a thing, right? You can also post about it on social media or write a positive review or give it some stars where that's a thing. All of these things are super helpful, so thank you so much to everybody who is doing this stuff. Oh yeah, and don't forget to decisively smash that follow button so you can get updates when a new episode comes out. You can find Lux Occult, Hello Void, and other merch available at lumenindustries.com, which is my Etsy store. Items will be printed on demand using the most eco-friendly options I could find and shipped directly to you at pretty close to cost. So there's some fun stuff in there and more to come. All right, let's do listener mail and shoutouts. All right, shout out to Brusana, who shared this very cool mathematical tidbit with me. So Brusana writes, "One of the many small ways that make me feel like I've been connected to Hecate is that one of my math teachers in high school taught me that you can tell if a number is divisible by 3 by summing all the digits until you are left with a single number. And if that number is divisible by 3, the whole number is. For instance, I can tell you that 108 is divisible by 3 because 1 plus 8 equals 9, and 9 is, of course, divisible by 3. 123 is because 1 plus 2 plus 3 equals 6. 59453 is not divisible by 3 because 5 plus 9 plus 4 plus 5 plus 3 equals 26, and 2 plus 6 equals 8. And that's not divisible by 3. So this is one of the first things I do when I hear a number and I have the mental bandwidth or time to do the calculation. So I fucking love that, Brusana. Thank you so much for sharing. I love little mathematical tidbits. And of course, 3 is one of the most magical numbers, as we all know. Fuck yeah. Shout out to StarPilgrim777 on Instagram. Glad you're into what me and my guests are up to here. Fuck yeah. Shout out also to Seedperson, stoked that you found us in the project. As I mentioned before, it was really, really cool to meet some of the amazing folks from the Green Mushroom Project at Babylon Rising. It was such a chill and comfortable feeling to be there among friends and to get to experience all types of cool rituals and workshops and really have so many interesting conversations. It's all still sinking in, but I met some really cool people, and yeah, I just can't wait for next year. So shout out to all the fucking amazing people that I met at Babylon Rising. There's too many to list here, plus I'm horrible with names and I would feel like a total asshole if I forgot somebody, but it was just such a pleasure to hang out in person with people who I've been interacting with and doing magic with online and everything. Yeah, just so many cool moments, you know, our impromptu LARPing adventure to capture Dick Bat and Tit Shield, drunken piggyback rides, rituals, fun around the campfire. Yeah, I could go on and on. And hopefully we'll come back to this in the future and do a little bit of reflection, because there's just so much there. So before I let you go, I'm going to go ahead and share some writing that Jack Parsons did, and then we'll do some closing thoughts, which is going to be Ramon's advice for seeking out more wildness in your life. All right, so what I'm going to share with you now is an excerpt from a letter that Jack Parsons wrote to Marjorie Cameron on the 6th of February 1950. And you can find a nice compilation of these letters and some of Jack's other writing in the book Jack Parsons' Babylon Workings by Riordan McWilliam, who's the one who put it all together. Okay, so Jack Parsons writes, "Thinking is a language. Language is words, and the world is a literary creation. That is why a dash of humbug is necessary for any real success. Humbug raised to the pitch of fine art. That is why art finally gets bored with its own perfection and winds up deliberately distorting itself, seeing how far it can go into the ludicrous and still keep touch with perfection. It is all a question of spiritual vitality, of maintaining contact with the secret center that assures us that everything is really a high lark. The weaker sink down and are absorbed. The stronger may sink, but they pop back up again with a new and better angle. The secret strength is actually in death, in the link with eternity that we wear in our bones. Our true self moves in life and death, in eternity and duality, as we move in sunlight and in shadow, and with as much concern. We dance to the pipe of Pan, whether we know we dance or not. And the last and greatest truth is the joy, the pure, sheer joy of the dance. On the face of the dancing Shiva at Delhi, someone has carved it, some music, some words open on a window on infinity, and we look suddenly on Arcady. Only the cry, the whine of the self keeps us from it, forgetting that, and we step into it as easily as across the door. Remember this, my dear. What your karma has put upon you, no one knows but your deep self. It may be to set the world on fire, or to know, to keep your counsel, and be at peace and joy. But none of these are to be sought after. It is only to know yourself, to find yourself, to be yourself. That, and that alone, is the way.
Alright, fuck yeah.
So as we move through the world, beset on all angles by the forces of domestication, remember Ramon's advice. Seek out wild places. Seek wild allies, like cats. Seek out wild experiences, like ecstatic states. Avoid the middle. Become unhurtable. Do magic. Make death more beautiful by recontextualizing it. And remember what Jack Parsons says too. Fucking be yourself. Resist. Resist by maintaining sovereignty of the self. Resist by maintaining love of the self. Resist by maintaining fierce loyalty to love and pleasure. Resist with acts of radical kindness. Focus on the path to better times. Fuck yeah. Thanks so much to Ramon Castellano, sent a flood from XV Planis. And most of all, thanks so much to you for listening. This is Lux Estrada, reminding you to stay strong, stay wild, and stay fucking curious.
Lux Occults is a part of the Green Mushroom Podcast Network.
I'm Steve.
And I'm Jason.
And we're the hosts of an explorative podcast called Grognostics, where we mix in one part of curiosity, one part comedy, one part craft beer tastings, one part education, and yet one part fictional stories. Good Lord, that's a lot of parts.
Look, the show's really cool, okay?
I don't know, I'm not so sure now. Sounds more confusing than the time we came over early to your Christmas party last year and found you bawling your eyes out, pantless, mind you, to a Lance Bass Hallmark movie.
That was a phase, Jason. A phase, I tell ya.
Look, if you want to listen, grab a cold one and tune in on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You might even learn a thing or two.
That's Grognostics, Grognostics. Look, my pants were in the dryer. Lance just happened to be on.
Sure, buddy. Sure.
What scares you?
Ghosts. Aliens.
Monsters?
The occult? Conspiracies?
Some of you like to be scared, and unearthing paranormalcy is for you.
Some of you try everything you can to avoid it. Unearthing paranormalcy is for you.
We take the topics that scare some, and we dig in to find the source, then present the history to make the paranormal a little more normal.
We also throw in a bit of comedy to shed a light on some of the darkness in the world.
So whether you're scared of bumps in the night, what's inside your own mind, or strange lights in the sky, we cover it all.
We dig in and present all that we find and try to come up with some logical
and not so logical
reasons for the high strangeness happenings.
Sometimes we are scared of the things we don't understand, and the more we understand, the less we fear.
So find us, Unearthing Paranormalcy, on your favorite podcast app. And join us on Facebook, Instagram, and Discord at UMP Normalcy. And until next time,
keep digging.